Hey Trailblazers, we have some exciting news here at the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We have partnered up with Hilltop Packs, not just because they make amazing ultralight gear, but because they're a small family-run business doing huge things for our hiking and backpacking community. Every food bag, dry sack, fanny pack that you order can be completely customized. Print your trail name, your dog's face, your favorite mountain, or really whatever inspires you. When you shop at Hilltop Packs, you're not only buying gear that you're absolutely going to love, but you're supporting real families, real jobs, and small town craftsmanship. So head over to hilltoppacks.com and use code TTP10 to get 10% off of your order. Now on with the episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast. I'm your host, Jason. And today, coming to us all the way from Pedernales Falls State Park, we have Interpretive Ranger Steven. Steven, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Most important question. I was looking at the temps today, and I noticed here down in Houston, we had a, I'm going to call it a cold front. So we dropped from the 100 degrees to maybe low 90s, upper 80s. What about you guys? How's the weather? Is it starting to turn for you?
It felt pretty nice yesterday when it first came through. The rain was really, really nice. Today it's getting back into the upper temperatures and getting hot again, especially in the sun.
Yeah. So now it's kind of tradition. It's maybe been going on about 2 months. I have a little thing that I like to kick the podcast off with called the lightning round. Kind of warms us up. It kind of, you know, breaks the ice. So to the listeners, as they know, Steven, you have not seen these questions. And so they're going to be just first words that come to your mind. And are you ready?
Sure, I'm ready.
All right. Favorite trail in the park?
Heckenberg Loop.
One word to describe Pedernales Falls State Park?
Rugged.
What is your favorite place to hike?
Definitely the falls.
Funniest thing you've ever overheard a visitor say?
Oh, that's going to take a while. I guess I had to laugh when I heard someone describing all the rocks at the falls as volcanic.
Are you a sunrise or sunset hiker?
Ooh, definitely sunset.
What's tougher to manage, the heat or the crowds?
At this point, it's the crowds.
What's your go-to trail snack?
Beef jerky.
Coolest animal you've spotted at the park?
Black-tailed rattlesnake.
Oh, wow. One trail at the park that you can hike blindfolded because you know it so well?
I have to say the falls.
Most important thing first-timers coming to the park must know before arriving?
That reservations may be needed in order to get in at the time that you want to get in.
Yes or no? Have you ever answered a visitor's question and then it made you pause and think, did they really just ask me that?
Yes, absolutely.
What part of the park do you hope never changes?
That's hard to say because everything is changing constantly. I would say the Twin Falls area would be the one I want to preserve.
What would you tell a brand new park ranger starting their very first day there?
Experience as much as you can of the park.
Would you rather clean the park restrooms after a busy holiday weekend or lead a group of 20 unsupervised fifth graders on a hike?
Definitely a guided hike.
Would you rather talk someone out of trying to pet a wild animal or explain for the 20th time why feeding wild animals is a bad idea?
I'd explain it.
This is the last question and the most important question. The listeners know what's coming. This will dictate how long and the direction of the podcast going forward. What is your favorite Texas hiking podcast that you've been a guest on?
I'd have to say the Trailblazing Texas podcast.
I love it. A bat in a thousand. It just warms my heart. As we kind of get started in the episode, I think it's important for me, And also to the listeners, because I do get feedback, to kind of, outside of talking about the park and how wonderful the park is really to get to know you and your role at the park. So just how long have you been with the Texas Parks and Wildlife?
I've been in the agency for about 10 and a half years now.
Oh, wow. Is this your first park or has there been other parks?
I started at Cedar Hill State Park, which is up near Dallas. And I was a CSR there. I worked in the office checking people in. And I gradually rose through the different jobs, through maintenance, then back to customer service, and moved here to Pedernales Falls about 7 years ago.
Wow. So what brought you to Pedernales Falls?
The geology, the rocks and the geologic formations, way better than anything Cedar Hill had. And I really liked the people that come out to the park as well. I like talking with any visitors that come out and join the trails.
So as an interpretive ranger, what role does that look like at Pedernales Falls?
At Pedernales Falls, we have a lot of natural resources that we want to protect. And the best way to protect them is to help have the public help us out. And so my role is educating and explaining our natural resources and why they're so important and what we can do to help protect them in a way that many different audiences can understand. So I deal with school groups with little, you know, kids, but also have senior groups that come out and mixed families, and interpreters are trained to communicate with all those different audiences and use terminology that many people can understand.
So mainly just kind of an educational aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think makes Pedernales Falls unique compared to other state parks that you've either visited or worked at?
I think the geology is definitely one of the most unique things about it. We have a really special place where two rock layers meet, and you get some really cool topography that allows the river to make these beautiful pools and cascading waterfalls. And that's something that a lot of parks don't quite have. But I think we also are one of the larger state parks in the area. And that way we offer a lot more trails, a lot longer trails that people can experience.
So this is a funny question. And I'm just saying that because, you know, I've already had about 7 or 8 state parks recorded the episodes. And they all have the same answer to this question. So what does a typical day look like for you out there at the park?
There's definitely not a day that seems like it repeats. Every day is a little bit different. I'm sure they all told you the same thing too. Sometimes I spend my days helping out and cleaning restrooms, picking up trash, taking pictures for social media, checking on the trails. But then other days I'm leading a guided hike down to the river, talking with visitors at an overlook, just seeing how they're doing, checking in with visitors at the front office. You might see me behind the desk there, or even responding to search and rescue events whenever they happen in the park.
And I think this is probably the first park that's been on the podcast of your popularity where, you know, all the parks leading up until this point, even with, like, you know, some of the smaller parks, that it's how important the reservations are. And I think with your park, this is the first park on the podcast that we'll probably get into it a little bit later. But to the listeners, this park, you definitely need a reservation. I've been there, I don't know, 3 or 4 times. And yeah, it was, it gets pretty busy pretty quick. And if you don't have a reservation, that's on you. What is something that you love about your job that probably visitors or, you know, the people that visit the park aren't going to see?
I love the conservation and natural science aspect of my job. A lot of folks don't get to see that in the public view, but helping prepare a site for prescribed burn, counting birds by memorizing their call, logging plants that I find onto an international database so we can know more about them. Even helping research scientists come out to the park, I help them get to the site that they're going to research at. Seeing that my work is helping advance science is pretty fulfilling. It's been really an exciting part of my job.
Nice. So what do you wish every first-time visitor understood before arriving at the park?
For first-time visitors, don't rush. Take your time, explore the park, and you'll notice a lot more things that you might have not seen before if you're hurrying through everything. Make sure to set plenty of time to explore and get here early. But also, literally, don't rush. Slow down. We have speed limits for a reason. We have a lot of wildlife out here, and our speed limits are a little low. That way, we're giving our animals plenty of time to get across without any danger. And we also have a lot of people enjoying the park on the sides of the road, riding bikes, taking their kids in strollers. So slow down when you arrive, enjoy the park, and keep your eyes open for stuff that you might miss if you're rushing.
And as many times as I've been to the park, what shocked me is I, you know, kind of went back and looked at the park map and how massive the park is. It has the falls, the river, and those are absolutely spectacular, and you should definitely visit those areas. But don't forget that there's so much more to the park. I mean, it's massive, and exactly what you said, take your time. Like, hopefully you can plan a visit where it's more than one day, because I think to see everything that you would want to see, it would definitely take more than one day at the park. So if you could show one part of the park to a first-time visitor, what would it be and why?
I think I would choose a spot along Hackenberg Loop Trail. It's a spot where there's some very tall cypress trees, and it's got some pretty deep water in that area, very pretty, but also very quiet. It's pretty far away from where most of the crowds go. And the thing I like most about it is that you can see firsthand the destructive power of flash floods. There are cypress trees that are 4 feet wide that have been living for hundreds of years, and they were ripped out of off their roots and are currently leaning up against live cypress trees. So you have a dead log just right there showing you how powerful the floods can be.
Speaking of that and flash flooding and stuff, when you go and you kind of hike down to the river, you definitely, it's pretty amazing how the water is cut into the rock. So what is the story behind the river and its iconic falls, and how were they formed?
So the river is fed by creeks and springs from here all the way to 60 miles west of us by Fredericksburg. And the water coming into the river is mostly rainwater with a little bit of spring water mixed in. When we get major rain events, that water turns very destructive. And as it goes through the river canyon here, you can see where there's bends in the river. And as the water travels through, it's eroding away on the outside bend while depositing sand and silt on the inside end. And so you get these really tall, jagged cliffs. And then on the other side, you get sandy, gravel-like shores. And so that's some of the major features we see out here. But the falls themselves flow over very, very old rocks that are tilted at about a 15-degree angle. Those are all sedimentary rocks from about 300 million years ago, in which we had an ocean over Texas. And at the bottom of that ocean, mud was collecting, mud from microscopic creatures that had calcium-rich shells. And so that mud eventually got buried for long enough that it compacted and cemented into limestone. And that's what we see at the falls is very, very old limestone rock layers that after a collision with a continent, those rocks got slanted into a 15-degree angle. And now as the water has been digging down to those rocks, as it exposes these tilted rocks, the water flowing through them creates these little cascading waterfalls that slide down from one to the next. And because of the way they're laying on each other, plunge pools are pretty easy to make down there. So as the water travels down, it erodes these pools. They get deeper and deeper and deeper over time. And that's how the falls area has basically been formed. Floods, long-time erosion, but erosion into these rocks that are very, very, very old.
One thing that it struck me the first time that I was there, and you know, you hike down to the river and you see these pools and the water is just rushing through these channels. If you look upstream, the elevation of where this water's coming from, yeah, that was pretty spectacular. When there is a heavy rain, are you all being notified, like upstream, that, hey, you know, this is where, you know, whatever city, and we've just had 3 or 4 inches and it's coming your way, to, you know, to alert hikers that, okay, guys, we need to probably back out of this area because at some point we're going to get a lot of water running through here.
Yeah, the city of Johnson City has a meter that's placed there by the Lower Colorado River Authority, the LCRA, and they have a website that you can log into, and no login required, but you go to the website and you can see what the meter is doing there. You can see how fast the river is flowing, how high the river is, and you have a graph as to how fast everything rose. That gives us a pretty good idea that there's water coming down the river. And it's about 12 miles upriver, so it does take about anywhere from 7 to 12 hours before that water leaves Johnson City and arrives at the park. Unfortunately, all the land between here and Johnson City is privately owned, so there is no public infrastructure along that stretch to tell us if, you know, rain fell between Johnson City and our park. We won't have any warning that there's water coming down until we see it at the falls.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever weather does come in and falls in that one little dead zone, we patrol the falls pretty often, and we also begin closing down trails and warning people to get out of abundance of caution.
Yeah. So can you give us a little bit of an explanation of the park's history and how it became a Texas state park?
Sure. Depending on how far back you want me to go, there were Native Americans living out here, and we found many different sites and artifacts where they would make their artifacts or set up camp. We don't have any evidence of permanent settlements, but small camps. And many of these people we don't know much about. The artifacts are very, very old, before the tribes that we do know lived in the area. So we send those artifacts in for study. But the tribes that the Spanish encountered when they came out here included the Tonkawa, the Apache, and the Comanche. And the Spanish never did build anything out here this far out from San Antonio. But over time, the first European origins settlers moved into the park across the river on Cypress Mill Loop. Four families that were somewhat related, others were just friends, and they had homesteads in the park for a while in the 1860s and the 1870s. But in the 1890s, drought was beginning to scare them off, so they moved away. As the land went up for sale, a prominent ranch owner in Johnson City, he began buying up small parcels of land that eventually would be joined all together to become Pedernales Falls State Park. So J.B. Wenma was the first one to own what is now the park. And he would ranch. He had a lot of cattle out here. He built fences. He built a lot of infrastructure. And but over time, the Great Depression eventually made him have to sell the ranch. And he sold to a wealthy family named the Wheatleys. And the Wheatleys were actually big into conservation. They loved hunting and fishing, and they knew that in order to enjoy their hobby, wild animals had to have a habitat to live in. So they began to allow the park to regrow. And the ash juniper spread like crazy. The live oak grew in all over the place. And unfortunately, what had been a prairie had been turned into a forest. But that allowed white-tailed deer and turkey to thrive. And the river had a ton of catfish and bass for fishing. And so they really enjoyed their time out here, so much so they wanted to make sure that all Texans had the ability to enjoy this place. And they sought out many different agencies for this, but eventually they settled on Texas Parks and Wildlife. And we bought it in 1970 from them with a grant for a little bit less than $1 million, about $900,000. And in 1971, we finally opened up to the public, and it's been a state park ever since. So we're just over 50 years. And we did put improvements to allow us to enjoy the park without destroying vegetation or anything. So we have roads, we have trails, we have bathrooms and a campground. That was all put in after we bought the park. It's largely remained mostly unchanged ever since.
So are there any like special areas in the park or signs of, like you were talking about, Native Americans or early settlers in the park?
Yes, there's actually the ruins of a stone building close to a place we call Jones Spring, which is the old Trammell House. And you can see it was a pretty small house, but they had a large family living in it. There's also places you could find evidence of fencing, stone and juniper fences. There's an old chimney on Cypress Mill Loop that you might be able to see from the trail. There's also a lot of leftovers from the ranching days. So we have barns, we have corrals, we have fences from that time period. Native American artifacts, most of them were recovered by archaeologists, and we're studying them currently in Austin. So if you do find any of those, please leave them where they are. We'll bring in professional archaeologists to help study those.
My heaven on earth is Guadalupe Mountain National Park. I've been there a bazillion times. I've hiked and backpacked the whole park. There's two items on my bucket list is to see a mountain lion out there and to find an arrowhead. And I was at Mustang Island State Park and going through like the Rangers program there. And there was a ranger there and he had, you know, arrowheads and stuff that were, I guess, uncovered at the park. And so we were talking about it and I'm like, yeah, you know, at the quads, that's one of my bucket lists is to find one. And he's like, and you're going to leave it there, right? And report it. And I'm like, well, I was going to grab it. He goes, no. You're going to leave it, right? And I'm like, yes. So I think it was the episode with Kenny at San Angelo. We were talking about that. And yeah, so to the listeners, if you find any artifacts, take a picture, go to find a ranger and report it, but do not pick it up. So that's my new bucket list item is to take a picture and call it a day.
Yeah, that really does help because these artifacts, a lot of times, if we just by the type of artifact it is and the location it was found, archaeologists can use that to make new maps of where these people used to live.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So I definitely learned that, and that definitely a supporter of that for sure. Let's talk about just a normal day at the park, normal water levels, normal flow. Do you all have the responsibility to monitor the river, the safety, and then also, you know, people hiking down to it or swimming in it? How does that impact you guys?
So swimming is at your own risk. There are special circumstances in which we do close down the river to swimming. We had to close down the falls to swimming for a different reason. But yeah, the river, we try to monitor it as best we can. We don't have any official equipment down in the river to monitor the at the speed or anything. We do take water out of the river, and so we do treat that here in the park to provide drinking water and restroom facilities. We can test the quality of the water as we take it out of the river, but that's the extent of how much official equipment we have to test everything. So whenever we do see online or in person that the river is rising, we do our best to spread the word. We have megaphones that we can blast warnings across the riverbed, and we close off the trails. That's the extent of what we do. And thankfully, most of the park, most of the infrastructure has been built well above the floodplain, because we get floods so often, it's not worth it to build anything down where it can be destroyed again. When a flood comes through, as long as everyone's out of the river, it's a fun thing to watch.
Oh, I can't imagine watching that. I mean, just on a normal light day, the pools and the waters flowing through those little caves, it's pretty spectacular. I couldn't imagine seeing it where it starts up at that elevation and just covering all the rock and just flying through there. It definitely has got to be pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
Being at the park for as long as you have you been part of or seen any major conservation efforts or restoration projects in the park?
Yeah, there have been several throughout the years, but the most recent one that I was a part of was a federal grant that we received to pay for large machines to come through. And our park is largely overrun with ash juniper trees, which are native. They're supposed to be along the creeks and the rivers, but the previous owners and the previous activity out here allowed the ash juniper to grow into what used to be grassland. So we had machines come in and we took out all the ash juniper across a 600-acre section that were younger than a certain age. So we knew they were here because of human activity. And after the trees were taken out and mulched, we've been doing prescribed burns through there. And the prescribed burns mimic wildfires that used to come out here. It used to be fires that would spread across Texas, and it was a natural reset button. It would burn through the grassland, the grass would grow back within 2 months, and the ash juniper, if it got caught in a wildfire, would be completely burned down. So that was the natural way of controlling the ash juniper population, was just a wildfire going through. And that's what we mimic here in the park.
And for these control burns, is when they're scheduled, is the whole park closed or just like certain sections?
Just certain sections. So we never burn the entire park all at once. It's just the small, we have a a map where we've designated certain sections and we have fire breaks in between them to make it easier to control.
So I live about an hour from both endpoints of the Lone Star hiking trail. So this, you know, the longest trail in Texas through the Sam Houston National Forest. Oh, wow. And I'm usually out there every Sunday. And there was a time where they had a scheduled control burn. Well, I didn't pay attention to where it was happening. Got to the trailhead with my friend. It was, I guess, about 3:30 in the morning because we had a big day planned. And I guess the sign had blown down, or, you know, that the trail was closed. And so we get about 10 miles in and, you know, you start, man, it's smoky. I wonder what's, you know, maybe down the, you know, somewhere else there's a control burn or something, or somebody's burning trash. And then we see these pine trees, and in the tops of the pines, they're sparking. So like, it's like these fires are exploding kind of. And we're like, what the heck? And we start looking at the ground, and it's on either side of the trail, it's pitch black. And we're like, oh man, we're in the middle of a prescribed burn. So like, okay, do we keep going forward? Do we turn around? And it was probably about another mile into it. It looked like, you know, the sun's coming up, but there's an area where there's water on both sides of the trail, and you're kind of like hiking on this jetty or a dike. We can, oh, is it, you know, it's getting light over there. We rounded this corner and like the whole field is on fire. So we're like, all right, we got to turn around. And and you know, I would have expected like they would have somebody at the trailhead say, you know, but yeah, it was a sign, and I guess, you know, it blown down or whatever. But yeah, we hiked through most of it, and it was an experience. Being at a park the size of Pedernales, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges that you all face kind of managing the park, and especially, you know, that you're throwing in a river?
One of the biggest problems has actually been how popular we are. We get so many visitors coming out on, especially weekend days, that are, you know, large crowds coming from Austin and San Antonio. It creates problems like full parking lots. And if a parking lot's full, a lot of folks don't think, I'm going to look for another parking lot. They pull off onto the grass and destroying natural resources and wildflowers. We have long lines to check in, long lines at the bathrooms, and I've even seen lines to stand at an overlook. That's how busy it gets. Crowds put a strain on things like bathrooms, drinking water supply, trails, and the emergency responders that have to respond to an accident out here. The more people we have, the more accidents, unfortunately. So this is not a new challenge. It's not one that's just limited to our park. Texas Parks Wildlife, we implemented a long-requested upgrade to our website back in 2019 that allows people to reserve their day pass ahead of time. And this allows us to set a limit to certain times of the day how many people can come out to the park. And if everyone's making the reservations and arriving when they said they're going to arrive, it's going to stagger their arrival. That way people that come in early in the morning, they're heading out by the time the next time slot comes in. And so we have a constantly recycling parking lot where people are coming in and going out, and it's actually allowed us to have more people in the park, but it doesn't feel that way because people are coming in, staying for a little bit, heading out, and it's worked very, very well. But it's those time slots where you have so many people coming out without reservations that it ends up pushing us to that limit pretty quickly. Yeah, we've had to turn people away, tell them, hey, we're full up right now, we'll come back in a couple hours. If you don't have a reservation, that could happen.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest message that I've learned over the last two or three months. First off, you should have a reservation. And even if like you're driving to the park, make a reservation, because I learned from Nick at Government Canyons, he had a park host, and they calculated the time it takes for a visitor just to show up with no reservation versus one with a reservation. And, you know, the person with no reservation, it was like 17 mouse clicks and some other things, versus if you had a reservation, it's two or three mouse clicks and you're gone. So you're not holding up people trying to get your day pass or whatever you're there for. So to the listeners, always, always, always make a reservation.
Yeah.
Even to the smaller parks. It just helps everybody.
It's definitely helpful. It helps us, and that means y'all get in a lot faster. Like you said, it's not there because we don't want to have people coming out to the park. We want to have as many people as we can without destroying what we have here and without overtaxing the infrastructure that we have.
Let's kind of get into the trails of the park and some of the activities that visitors can take part in. So what do you think are some of the most popular trails in the park?
Definitely the most popular trail is the trail going down to the falls. It's a trail that's fairly easy. It's only a quarter mile to the overlook. And it's also a gentle sloping wide gravel trail. So folks with strollers and even wheelchairs have a decent time of getting down. And from the overlook, you can see the entire riverbed, the entire falls. And it's wide open and sunny. And it's a beautiful place to explore, rock climb, fish, and look for fossils.
Oh, wow.
Folks that are hiking, I'd say Wolf Mountain is one of the more popular ones. It's a trail that's, if you do the whole thing, it could be upwards of 8 miles. But you can also do a 2 mile section and 2 mile back. And that one is a double wide. Old Ranch Road is great for hiking and for mountain biking.
So if you just kind of look at the park in its entirety, are there any hidden gem hikes or corners of the park that often go overlooked that you still think that are, you know, that would be pretty spectacular for someone new?
It does depend on what you're looking for, but one of my favorite overlooked trails is Juniper Ridge and the Madrone Trail. These are trails that are very long, but they follow a ridgeline that has a lot of shade. And so it's a single track trail that was intended for mountain biking, and you rarely see anybody on them. It's one of those trails that doesn't have a scenic overlook, but it's a lot of fun just to hike and experience the birds that are out there, the wildlife that's out there, and it's very, very quiet. But another seldom hiked trail is Cypress Mill Loop. That's on the other side of the river. You have to cross the river to get there, and that's why a lot of folks decide not to go on it. They don't want to get wet. But if you're willing to get wet, take a little towel with you, take your shoes off, cross the river there, and then dry your feet off and put your shoes back on. It's a great trail, and it ends in a really spectacular overlook that overlooks the hills and the river.
So what all are the activities that visitors can partake in visiting the park?
Well, there's hiking, mountain biking, if you bring your own mountain bikes. Fishing is available. People come out here to bird. Stargazing as well. Swimming. You can swim in the river. You can wade. You can tube and kayak, but it's a little bit difficult. Don't usually recommend it unless you have a solid plan as to where you're going to get out. And camping, picnicking. There's places you can have campfires and fire charcoal pits.
So for your campsites, is there any primitive or is it all kind of like car camping where you pull up front country type stuff?
Yeah, we have both. We've got sites that you can have an RV in where you pull up to your site. There's a parking spot and the table's right there next to it with a fire pit and everything. But we also have campsites for those that want a backpack. And if you want to take everything you need for your stay in one backpack and hike 2 miles out to your campsite, there's an area called the Primitive Camping Area, and there's no numbered sites there. It's just an open area that you can choose where you want to set up your tent. And there's no fires out there, but it's a really quiet place to practice your backpacking skills.
And for the Primitive, is it pit toilets out there or wag bags you have to have? Or
there is a Primitive toilet out there, a chemical toilet.
And so you brought up mountain biking. Is it pretty popular out there?
Yeah. In fact, we had a group out of Austin. They came out and created Juniper Ridge for us. They made that trail a while back. I think it was about 20 years ago. It was made mainly for mountain biking, but it's also a very technical mountain biking trail. It's pretty difficult. We have a lot of people coming out to do Wolf Mountain, to bike right on the main road. Not all of our trails can be mountain biked, and we do have it on our map. A little symbol saying, hey, don't mountain bike here. But for the most part, there's a lot of availability here.
If you look at the trail map of the park, are all trails open to hikers? And then there are some that are open to mountain biking or?
All trails are open for hiking. Not all trails are open for mountain biking. And we also have horseback riding available here at the park if you bring your own horse. And there are a set number of trails just for horseback riding too.
Okay. And what about hikers that got to bring their dog, or the trails pet friendly, or
yeah, we love seeing people bring their dogs out here in the appropriate time. It does get too hot during some days to bring your dog out, but all the trails are open for dogs as long as you keep them on a leash at all times. We do have a lot of dangerous animals out here, and unfortunately, dogs are the first ones to find them. So keep your dog on a leash, and we also have people that bring dogs that definitely need to be on a leash. They're maybe a little bit too violent. A friendly dog walking up to a violent dog is not a good mix. So, yeah, bring your dog out. Make sure that they're on a leash, and please clean up after them. Bring some doggy bags with you, and because that can negatively affect our wildlife, leaving behind dog droppings.
And also, if you're gonna bring a dog, you're gonna pick up after him, don't leave the droppings at the trailhead. Go ahead and just throw them in your car and take them home with you.
Yeah, or use one of our trash cans. We got plenty of trash cans at most of the trails.
So, are there any sections or areas that you would recommend for watching the sunrise or sunset inside the park?
Sure. Sunrise, there's a good spot just north of where the park headquarters is on one of the horse trails. It's an orange trail on the map. And there's a spot that you can just sit down and watch the sun rise in the east. For the sunset, my favorite place to go to is the falls. Go out to the falls and you start hiking upriver. You hike upriver until there's a cliff in between you and the sun. And you sit there and you can see the sun slowly disappear behind the cliff. And when it's cloudy, those colors just paint the entire riverbed.
For a visitor, what kind of wildlife do people regularly spot in the park?
So the largest animals people see regularly include the white-tailed deer, coyotes, gray foxes, raccoons, of course, especially if you're camping, but also armadillos, turkeys, and occasionally feral pigs. We do have those in the park. For folks that are looking to more intently for wildlife, we got a whole bunch of native birds that people come out to watch and to count. So that's usually pretty exciting to see.
Yeah, that's one thing since having the state parks come on the podcast is realizing that I never knew birding was such a thing. But, man, it's especially in Texas and in the south of where I'm at, it's looks to be pretty massive. And that was shocking to me. When backpackers are out in the backcountry camping, should they hang their food? Or have you heard that we're in the primitive campsites are getting bothered by animals trying to get to the food? Like how should they store these types of?
No, that's a great question. We do have animals that will try to get into your trash or into your food. We don't have bears. We're still too far away from bear country to have that be a worry. But raccoons, they are notorious for getting into any manner of storage. So whether it's an ice chest or a plastic box or Tupperware or a bag up in the trees, they get into all of it. So we just recommend doing your best to seal away food. And if you have a car that you can lock it in, do that. If you're in the backcountry doing some backpacking, go ahead and tie it up in a tree if you can, because they will break into your tent when you're gone.
So are there any rare or protected or endangered species that call the park home?
Yeah, one of my favorite birds, the golden-cheeked warbler, has been spotted a lot in the park. And we do surveys to monitor its population. But they're here from March through the end of July. And there's also a species of salamander that we're still studying. So we don't have a name for it yet. But it's a salamander that is native just to a certain aquifer. And we hope to have more studies on that pretty soon. Very, very tiny salamander. I don't even have a picture of it yet.
Wow, that's cool. When, let's say for birding or just wildlife in general, what are the best times of the year to visit the park?
Ooh, it definitely depends on if you're looking for a specific bird, but we have over 150 bird species that travel through the park, and the springtime is probably the best and easiest time to find spring birds anyway, because they're going to be migrating into the park, and they're going to be calling out with a very specific call. And there are apps you can download that will help you identify what call you're hearing, and that can help you find the bird itself wherever it is in the trees and know what to look for. So I love spring birding, but winter birding is also a lot of fun. We get a lot of birds from up north, from Canada, from northern North America, that come down just for the winter, and they're foraging for food everywhere they can, and we see them at our bird blinds. We see them in the trees flocking together. It's a real exciting time for both spring and winter.
So how would you say the seasonal changes impact the park and what people might see from a wildlife perspective or from just a landscape perspective?
Sure. Spring, like I mentioned, we get those spring birds coming in, and it's a really exciting and really loud time in the park. They're all calling over each other, so you definitely can experience that. But the springtime vegetation, it gets very bright green, and the flowers begin to pop. We usually get blue bonnets first, and then we start getting more of the oranges and yellows and reds and purples later on. So it's a very busy time. The birds are in, the plants are blooming, and the insects are abundant. So you got all sorts of pollinators flittering about from flower to flower. So that's a really exciting time. But once we get into summer, the flowers begin to wilt, the grass begins to get a little browner, and the birds begin to stop singing because it's mating season's over and preparing for their trip down south or up north. In the fall, we get some great colors in the trees, especially down at the river. The cypress trees are usually the first ones to turn colors, and I get some really bright oranges and reds, and it's really, really pretty. And we get a little bit of fall color out of the red oaks, too. But most of the trees in our park are evergreen, so whenever it's wintertime, the ash juniper and the live oak trees, they stay green the entire season. And everything else gets a little brown, though, in the winter.
So what's the strangest animal encounter that you've ever experienced in the park?
Well, hiking with my now wife, we were going down Hackenberg Loop. And as we get down to the river, there's a big boulder in the river that we always like fishing around. But as we start hiking past it, a very large water moccasin swims out from behind the boulder. And as soon as it sees us, it freezes. It's sitting on top of the water, just staring at us. We're staring at it, and no one's moving. I get a few pictures, and then you can see its tail start to move just so ever so slightly, and it begins to backtrack and backpedal back behind the boulder as if he was trying to stay unseen. And it was just really funny. Just reminded us that these snakes, they want to be left alone, and if they encounter a large animal like a human, they're scared, and they will do whatever they can to defend themselves if they have to, but more than likely, they'll either sit still or they'll leave.
Most of the time when I'm hiking the Lone Star Hiking Trail, it's between September and May is kind of my hiking season. Then if I can catch some summer days where I can manipulate the temperatures by starting early or late, then I'll go out. But during my hiking season, I bat 1,000 for running into a copperhead, coral snake, or a water moccasin on the Lone Star Hiking Trail. It's batting 1,000. I would take those odds to Vegas. And what's kind of weird, you know, or not weird, but they don't really, you know, they're not aggressive. And the only way that I ever see them is because they're trying to get away from me. So they shoot off in the leaves or something, and you kind of turn and look and you see them. But yeah, they're pretty spectacular to watch if you ever get the opportunity. And yeah, they're pretty chill.
Yeah.
How do you all educate the public about respecting the wildlife?
Well, obviously we have a lot of signs around the park. Not everyone reads the signs. So we do have a lot of in-person programs where you can come out for free and attend, for fun activities. But during the activities, we're also explaining why these animals are important and how some of our actions can negatively affect their entire lives. And so that's an important thing that we do. I hold guided hikes and table demonstrations, and we also do some outreach. We go out of the park and we tell people where they live and in schools, and we just talk about why this park's so important and what we can do to keep it as pristine as it is right now. But then we also do some social media stuff, always posting online, look at this amazing butterfly we saw. It's using these native plants to thrive.
So what is your favorite sound in the park?
I had another one up until a couple weeks ago. I experienced it for the first time. It's the sound a roadrunner makes when he's chittering to another roadrunner, and it clicks its beak together super fast. and makes a trilling sound, a very fast clicking trill. And I thought it was a high-speed camera the first time I heard it. And I went down to look for it, and sure enough, there's two roadrunners hopping through the trees, clicking at each other. It's a really fun sound, and it's on, if you look up Roadrunner on Audubon or All About Birds, it's the sound is on there. And I've been hearing it a lot more often now that I know what it is.
Yeah, my first Roadrunner experience was at South Llano River State Park, and I was setting up my tent. And, you know, you kind of hear something behind you, and I just turned and looked. And first off, I didn't realize how big they are. Like, I was thinking it would be just some little bitty skinny bird, but this thing was pretty big. And he walked right up to me and just kind of almost like he was on the side of me, just kind of looking at what I was doing. And his head was just kind of turning to the side. And then he would look up at me, and I'm just thinking, okay, what's about to happen? So like, I just slowly just kind of turned on my butt and just faced him. And, you know, he just kind of looked around and then just went off to kind of do his thing. I guess, you know, he was seeing if I had any snacks or something, but yeah, I didn't realize how this was a stocky, like, it totally different than what I was expecting. And it was definitely pretty spectacular. And then I ran into a turkey at Abilene. You know, I was packing up my tent and I heard this big thing come out of a tree. And this was maybe about 6 a.m, sun starting to come up, and a turkey just came up to the camp and just kind of checking out if I left any food on the ground, and then just gobbled its way, I guess, back home. But yeah, it's
wow,
pretty spectacular, if, you know, all the wildlife that our Texas state parks have, and then also the encounters that you could have. It's pretty amazing. What do you see are some of the most common mistakes that visitors make when they come into the park?
Definitely coming out during the hottest time of the day. If you can schedule it, please try to come out as early as you can. There'll be fewer people in the park, and it'll be nice and cool. But we understand a lot of schedules never quite always follow your own schedule, and so you may be coming out later than you intended. But if you do end up coming out during the hottest time of the day, please be heat conscious, be conscious of your own body, and drink plenty of water. It's a very dangerous time of the day.
I've been hiking and backpacking for maybe about 10 years, and it surprises me every year, whether it's a national park, one of our national parks, or a state park where you have fatalities due to heat stroke. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, you know, 110 degrees or 119 degrees at Big Bend. Like, what? Okay, why are you out there hiking?
Yeah.
It's, and I think it's a common for, you know, every other state park that's been on the podcast, it's they experience with guests not bringing enough water. You know, they may have some water, but it's never enough. And so, you know, the rescues that they have to do, and it's almost always heat or water related. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's bring more water than you can, and don't go out when it's 100 degrees outside or 95 degrees outside. You know, there's other options earlier in the morning or in the evening. But so I guess it's the same with you guys, the same type of issues that you face.
It's definitely one of the larger reasons for accidents.
Speaking of, let's say if a visitor gets in trouble, what is cell service like in the park?
It depends on your provider. We don't have a lot of towers around us, and so cell signal is usually spotty depending on who you have. So we have had instances where people got in trouble on the trail, were able to call 911, but they weren't able to keep a signal. The GPS location of their phone was still transmitted, and we were able to use that to find the person. So most of the time, as long as you have a fully charged cell phone, you should be able to use that in some capacity.
What kind of safety concerns should visitors have that you think is unique to Pedernales Falls?
Flash flooding is definitely one of those big ones. And flash flooding actually has caused another problem for us. It's polished all the rocks down to the falls, so they're super smooth. And even when they're perfectly dry with hiking boots, I slip and fall out there at least two or three times a month. So that's a big one. So slips and falls create broken bones and concussions. That's a big concern. Heat is probably the biggest concern most of the year, especially in the summertime. We have a lot of steep trails, and hiking on a steep trail in the heat of the summer is not a good combination. The rocks and the sand down to the river as well are in the sun all day long. So I've actually clocked a lot or measured a lot of those rocks in the 150 degree range, which is hot enough to burn skin. And people will bring their dogs out hoping that their dogs would enjoy walking out on those rocks, and then dogs get injured.
I think it was Enchanted Rock. They scanned a rock and it was 160 degrees, and they were talking that all the time people take their dogs out and, you know, there's dogs get injured in their pads of their paws, or they split open and get burned. It's kind of crazy if you think about it.
Yeah. Our dogs love us and they want to go everywhere they can with us. So they will follow you, but we've got to remember they handle heat differently than we do. They don't sweat, they pant, and it's easier for them to succumb to heat exhaustion before we do.
And so do you think for a visitor heading out to the park, is there anything kind of out of the ordinary prepping for the visit that they should do differently for Pedernales than other state parks, or is it pretty much the same?
A lot of it's the same. I always recommend bringing a large water bottle with you, or several, the kind that, you know, you reuse. The little plastic water bottles, a lot of folks, I see them bring one with them on the trail, and it's never enough. So a good size water bottle. But hiking poles are also pretty good to have as well, especially if you're having trouble going up and down stairs in the park. Having those hiking poles will really help out. And good hiking shoes. Hiking boot, or at least a shoe built for rough terrain, that'll really improve your time out there. It'll allow you to go to places that you wouldn't be able to go to with, you know, slippers or flip-flops. And it'll also help your feet in the end.
Upon a visit to the park, what's the best way for people to check the river conditions? Is it maybe calling the park? Is it through y'all's website, or...
Yeah, give us a call. When the office is open, it's usually open between 8 a.m. and 4:30. You can give us a call during that time, and we can give you an update over the phone. Otherwise, the LCRA website that I mentioned, it's called HydroNet. You can look at that for river conditions upriver from us, at least, and you can get an idea of what it'll be like down here. And we try to post updates on our Facebook page and Instagram whenever we can. We know people like to see what it looks like right now. We don't do that every single day. That would be tedious.
What are some of the park rules around swimming, jumping off rocks? Because, you know, it's got to happen.
Yeah. Swimming at the swimming area is pretty fun. It's at your own risk. It's a wild river, so there are dangers in that river. There are slippery, moss-covered rocks. There are fish and turtles and snakes and all the things you'd expect to see in a natural river. So it's at your own risk, but the swimming area is the safest place to go out of all the areas we have in the park. The falls area is closed to swimming. It's the only place we've closed it. No swimming whatsoever in that first 3 miles, but the swimming area is 4 miles long and there's plenty of space. It's got a lot of very shallow water in some places and deep water in others. And while we can't recommend jumping off rocks into the water, it's usually possible certain times of the year, depending on how much rain we've gotten. But the water does go up and down quite a bit throughout the seasons. So there's no designated rock you can jump off of.
Are there currently any trail closures or projects visitors should be aware of?
Yeah, the most recent project was a wastewater upgrade to our wastewater treatment. We had to close the Duck Pond loop for that. That trail is being rerouted right now. It's the only trail that's currently closed. Because of that project, we had a lot of construction throughout the park for several years, and it's finished. We're trying to regrow what was disturbed in those areas. So you may see some spots that are a little rough looking. They're not new parking areas. They're just soil that had to be dug up, and we're growing back the native grasses and the native wildflowers in those areas right now. But it will take a few years for it to fully return to what it used to be.
Any suggestions for families visiting with young kids or older family members?
Yeah, just remember that they're going to be affected by heat differently than you are. So make sure you're extra heat conscious with them. But the Falls area is one of my favorite places to take families. It's got a nice overlook that has a lot of shade. And so you can sit up there while the kids go down to the river. And it's pretty easy to see where everyone is from that vantage point as well. The bird blinds are also a great place to go. There's a lot of, they're enclosed buildings with a glass wall. And we feed the birds on the other side of that wall. And so you can sit down and relax and watch the birds sitting in a covered room with a fan inside.
All right. So as we start to kind of wrap up, this is your time to sell the park on why somebody should make this on their bucket list.
Well, Pedernales Falls is a beautiful park year round. And regardless if we have water flowing or not, the Falls area is just a fun place to explore. And the entire park has a variety of habitats, variety of different types of wildlife that you can experience and see in person. And there's so many different levels of hiking that you can experience, from just a gentle sloping wide trail to a really adventurous up and down rugged horse trail. So there's something for everybody. And there's so much of it that you can't experience at all in one day. So make a plan for doing one part this week, and then in a couple weeks, come back and do a different spot. And the river's always changing. So every time you go down there, it's going to look a little bit different than when you saw it last, especially if we had a flood. The floods changed the whole landscape down there. And it's just a park that you can experience over and over and over again and have a different experience every time.
So how many miles, I forgot to ask this question, how many miles are within the park?
We have more than 40 miles of trails here at the park.
Wow. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Yeah, you're not gonna day hike that.
Yeah. And there are groups that come out and they do trail runs out here in the park, mm-hmm. Usually overnight when it's cool. And they can combine those trails to make 60-kilometer loops.
Wow. That's pretty spectacular. Mm-hmm. All right, Stephen, I greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing all the information of Pedernales Falls. I've been there a few times, and it's one of my favorite parks. It does get busy to the listeners, so reservations, reservations, reservations. So I, again, greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast, and I will give you back your Monday, Labor Day, and thanks again.
Thank you for having me out. This was a pleasure.
And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode today, and stay tuned for our next episode where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.